You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Episode 113, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert is Dr. Melissa Cady. She's a pain specialist by training, although she no longer practices pain, and we're going to get into that in the show about why that is. She's the author of the book, Paindemic, which explores the nature of pain, how the treatment process is really messed up, and how in many ways it's not designed to actually make people feel better and to treat pain. But before we start the show, here's a quick message from MedEvolve, a company that empowers physician practices to work smarter with data-driven services. Are you tired of dealing with headaches like finding and retaining quality billing staff, high turnover, and limited resources? Many practices are opting to outsource all or part of their billing process to help relieve the burden of internal staff, free up resources, and reduce overhead costs. For those who wish to keep billing in-house, it's critical to have solutions that provide automation and give you the ability to monitor staff productivity and effectiveness, especially for remote employees. MedEvolve can help you leverage data and AI solutions that bring answers to the forefront and take the guesswork out of revenue cycle management. Let them show you how. To have this great company help you work smarter, reduce your costs to collect, and get paid on time, find them at drpodcastnetwork.com/MedEvolve. The link is also in the description of the show. I encourage you to go to theparadox.com/113 to find today's show notes, which include links to Dr. Cady's book and other useful links. Finally, I'd like to thank my patrons at patreon.com/theparadox. They help defray the costs for the production and the promotion of the show. And if you find value in the show and want to support it financially, it'd be much appreciated. You can do that, obviously, at the Patreon page at thepatreon.com/theparadox. Also, feel free to drop me a line on email at theparadoxshow@protonmail.com, or you can certainly go to the website at theparadox.com. Many of my show ideas, that comes from listeners, and I really appreciate it. And obviously, I super appreciate the fact that you share and promote the show with your friends, family, and colleagues. It's why the show continues to grow and why I'm now part of the Doctor Podcast Network. But let's get going to the show, The Paindemic with Dr. Melissa Cady. Enjoy. Well, I'm here with my friend, Dr. Melissa Cady. She's a co-host of the Change Physician Podcast and is an anesthesiologist working part-time in Austin, Texas. She's also the author of the book Paindemic. And today we're going to talk about her book. So Dr. Cady, thanks for joining the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. And we've done this a few times in different settings. So this is great.
We have. We're kind of guesting on each other's podcasts all the time. So the least I could do is return the favor. And I think you have a really interesting story and one that I want to make sure my listeners have an opportunity to hear. But let's start with kind of talk about you first before we get into the book and sort of the discussion about pain. How did you end up in medical school and then go into your fellowship training in pain?
Sure. Well, I've always loved being active and played sports and was a very curious, I guess, kid. And so I think I just naturally was inclined to get into personal training, which ironically is, I think, a little bit of a bridge there that made me curious about going to medicine. And it was mainly when I had clients that were having like back pain or they're having like heart issues. And it made me very nervous because I didn't really know if I was pushing them too much or what was safe and all of that out of concern for them. And, you know, and also feeling like the lack of knowledge didn't feel good, which I think is a lot of why sometimes not just wanting to help people, but there is a curiosity that has to go with being able to go through the grueling requirements of going through medical training. Yeah. Somehow we kind of normalize it when we're going through it because we're just so determined to get it done that we'll do whatever it takes. At least I speak for myself. But I went into, I went to UT, University of Texas at Austin, and I couldn't find this exercise science. I guess I had looked in the medical science degrees and didn't see anything there, but microbiology sounded really cool. So I was like, I didn't know much about it, but figured, you know, I'll learn some things. And halfway through, like 2 years into it, I realized kinesiology, science of exercise science, was in a college of education, and I didn't really want to switch over. Kind of wanted to finish, figured it was good enough. And then I started getting curious during my personal training during college that maybe I should just try for medical school. So I didn't have this big audacious goal of as a child that I want to be a doctor, but I thought about being a vet. I loved animals. But so I finally decided to apply to medical school. And in Texas at the time, there was kind of a universal system. It would apply to multiple schools, but there was one called the Texas Osteopathic or Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine in Fort Worth that was a separate application. So I applied to Texas and also this other one and was accepted into this Texas system, UT Houston. And then I was accepted to the osteopathic school. And meanwhile, of course, always having my mind being interested in multiple things, I thought it would be cool to be a massage therapist, you know, I could do that. So I literally got some things, you know, kind of squared away thinking about that. And so it was interesting because I loved the musculoskeletal system. I loved sports. I thought the musculoskeletal system was cool and how you can adapt your body. And so when I got accepted to both medical schools, I was like, well, this osteopathic stuff sounds really cool and interesting. And I think I always venture towards different, like, I'm always wanting to run off the path. And like, I didn't want to be in sororities. Like, I just want to be this independent person and do my own thing. So I think it all kind of collides in similar things, but I ended up going to the osteopathic school and I found it intriguing just to learn that other skill set. And so, you know, fast forward, I get through all this medical school and trying to figure out what I want to do as far as specialty. I still didn't have a clue. I liked everything, just like I found myself doing that, you know, going into medical school. So I think, you know, I realized that I just love learning and I'm just very curious. So I love physical medicine rehab, kind of tied into this musculoskeletal thing, but it was a very holistic look at the patient, have to understand the social elements, all of that. And then even primary care, internal medicine, thought about orthopedic surgery, had people trying to push me to go do that, and even some of the residents, you know, and I discovered, you know, when I was an intern. And, you know, I'm trying to decide, first of all, let me just say, I couldn't make up my mind to the point that I pigeonholed myself into maybe radiology, interventional radiology, because it's anatomy on the screen, in essence. And so I pigeonholed myself into a couple programs, which is just idiotic, to be quite honest. It's so competitive. And so I didn't get into that. So I had to scramble, and I got into general surgery, which I knew nothing about. Didn't even know what an NG tube was. So I ended up doing a year of general surgery. Whoa. I mean, talk about looking, feeling like an idiot on the first day and on grand rounds and being, you know, drilled by literally like a military kind of physician. And I just felt like the stupidest person on earth, but I learned so much. It was like a serious growth curve. But in that process, I realized I didn't like just writing orders. Like I didn't like telling a nurse what to do and not knowing how to do it myself. I know that sounds strange, but then I discovered anesthesia, obviously, inherently with surgery. And so I was accepted into the anesthesia program because I didn't get into radiology like the second time. And there was another year in there too. So, so all these connections, you can tell they're just erratic, just based on curiosity. So I did a year of general surgery, but because of the timing and not getting into radiology the second time, I had to go do another internship. otherwise had to pay back my loans.
Oh, like a transitional year sort of thing.
Right. Because the anesthesia stuff wasn't really, I didn't show interest till like after that initial process for that second year. So I went to another city in Texas called Temple, at Scott and White Hospital. I did a year of internal medicine, got a categorical position, meaning if I didn't come back to do anesthesia, I had a slot for like a 3-year period.
Yeah.
So I go and I do, and I mean, you think you're a glutton for punishment just going through the medical system and training, and I go and do 2 internships, which was not necessary. but at the same time, you can't go work at Whataburger and pay off your loans. So I couldn't take a year off. So I went and did that, had a great background when you think about it for anesthesia. If you have a year of general surgery, a year of internal medicine, you come back in and you do anesthesia. But the cool thing about anesthesia is that I could be one-on-one with my patient and I could do all the things that I felt like it just that nurturing nursing aspect. I felt like I get a portion of that in that process. And I also didn't want to be that person on a flight. Like if someone asks, is there a physician in the house or on the plane? I didn't want to be the person like, I don't know what to do. Like I felt like I actually had some skill sets that seemed legitimate as a physician. So so I landed myself in anesthesia, and through that anesthesia residency, this is where you're kind of getting at, is I discovered the pain service, the acute pain service, they called it. And I was just kind of fascinated to be able to take pain away, like in the traditional sense. And so in these acute pain situations, so I was drawn to that. I knew I was going through a lot personally. You know, I had, at the end of my anesthesia residency, decided to leave a very unhealthy marriage. And then I knew that if I wasn't going to, I was curious about pain, and there was that pain fellowship on site, same facility. I was like, okay, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. Cause I know that, you know, you see people leave and it's like hard to come back to training. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to tough it out for a year, and did my pain fellowship. But what was, if you look at all the stuff I told you and my curiosity and my love for just, you know, sports and being, I'm just very kinesthetically, I guess, associated with, I just love things that are part of movement. And so I learned also this osteopathic philosophy, which I think tied into my philosophy of my own anyway, that I think I kind of inherently developed through managing injuries on my own and kind of having faith and belief in the system that it can self-heal. And so when I was in my pain fellowship, I would see literally all of my fellows in my program would tell you that I saw like half the number of patients they did, spent more time with them, was willing to, I saw it as a challenge to just take on these most difficult patients because I was curious. I was just like,
yeah,
I want to hear the story. I want to like see if I can help them in ways. And then I would try to find a way to help them without doing the injections or doing the spinal cord stimulators. And it's like, I saw it as, okay, risk benefit. You know, as much as I love using my hands and doing things to people, I felt like I want to do the less risk thing. So I can use my hands, but I can maybe show them how to move their body or, you know, just have them be less fearful of movement and all these things that kind of tied in into what some PTs might do or whatever. So, I started having this hesitation to utilize some of the things I was being taught and started questioning when I was helping people, including a head surgeon, I'm not going to say names, but head surgeon's daughter who was having basically $1 million workup in the hospital and was still hurting. And I basically evaluated, I was asked by the director of the program just to evaluate because I just did things differently. And this is not to pat me on the back, because half the time I'm thinking, oh God, I hope this helps. and literally I did did my hands-on full evaluation, spent a lot of time with her, heard her story. Now, those are really important parts for something I say later, but I literally did a couple things and started moving and her pain went away. So you can imagine after $1 million workup, maybe poked and prodded. I can't remember all the details there, but to suddenly her, and I tried to make sense of why I had helped her and she was no longer having pain. Those are those kind of moments, those aha moments, like what are we doing here? And then seeing on the outside world, the private world, where they try one thing, didn't work. They'll try something else, didn't work. You know, they change the diagnosis code. They need to like play with the whole insurance game. And, but I'm like, why is this person hurting? Like, I didn't understand why we had to go to that extreme and do those things if I could help them in other ways or they could help themselves. So this is where it's interesting because most people that finish their pain fellowship go into practice.
Yeah, right.
I didn't. I felt pretty nauseated at the idea of practicing the way I like to practice and knowing damn well that I would not be able to afford the roof over my head because I wasn't doing the things that were lucrative. I was spending time with patients. I was doing things that didn't really get paid well. And so I was like, well, I'm just, you know, I've been a year off. I did a little bit of moonlighting during that year when I had time off. But I went back into anesthesia after a year of doing a pain fellowship, which is nerve-wracking in and of itself.
Yeah.
I mean, I have friends that went into pain and thought they should get out of pain and they feel like, I don't want to kill somebody. Like they're worried, you know, just getting back into the swing of things. So, do you want me to keep rolling with my story?
I think that's interesting because I feel like in our practice, we have people who are pain physicians who want to do some anesthesia and do the pain, and they have the same trepidation, right? Like I've not done anesthesia in 10 years. And I think the thing for people who are coming out of training, if you're a physician, you've finished your specialty training, you will understand this. If you're not, then you don't really understand what I'm about to say, but I'll try and explain it to you. When you do your residency, you are never the final check on whatever's going on, right? There's always someone you're attending. You can say, because the classic line is, right, I'm just the resident, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe just the fellow, right? And then when you go into training or when you leave training into practice, that's when you sort of figure out how you practice, right? And you use use the building blocks, the fundamentals that you learned in your residency training, and you sort of figure out how you do anesthesia, how you do general surgery, whatever the specialty might be. And that takes a few years before you kind of get a flow and get a feel for sort of how you do things. Yeah. And so to finish your residency where you're doing anesthesia all the time and then not do anesthesia for a year, when you never had the opportunity to sort of build that sort of familiarity and confidence, I can only imagine it's very unsettling. Like it'd be much different for me to leave anesthesia for a year and now go back because I've done it for, you know, 16, 20 years or something.
Sure.
And so for me to leave it, I mean, I could do it. I think probably after a couple of years, you definitely walk in rusty, and you know, it's a very procedurally oriented profession. And then I guess the other part about what you said that I think is interesting is the fact that you just knew that the reason people go into pain, that's not a fair thing to say. Let me start again. That to be successful financially in pain, you have to do certain things. And generally that means you have to do things. You can't sit and talk to people. The reimbursement rates for those sort of things are just much, much lower than doing, right? I mean, right, like doing epidurals and to do stellate ganglion blocks and all that kind of stuff, right? I think the allure of pain like you have is the acute stuff. And I think that's what I really enjoy doing when I do anesthesia. I love doing the nerve blocks and someone has like a totally dead arm for a day and their shoulder doesn't hurt or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's very satisfying. I know personally that I would struggle with chronic pain because I couldn't make that person better right away. Yeah. Right. The whole reason I went to anesthesia is because, oh, my blood pressure's high. I'll give you medicine. Boom. It's lower. My blood pressure's low. I'll give you medicine. Boom. It's higher. Yeah. I have instant gratification as an anesthesiologist. I would really struggle where I have to sort of slowly kind of make things better or to do it non-pharmacologically. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And which also explains why you went into be a DO, an osteopath, because that you were sort of definitely enamored with the fact that you could put your hands on someone and you can actually manipulate and do some things. And that comes through in the book as well. I mean, I can definitely see that it is a holistic approach to pain that you're looking at. So you wrote this book about the pandemic. I think I just kind of touched on a few things sort of. But why don't you describe why you wrote the book and what you felt you were trying to convey to people, I mean, you know, who your audience is?
Yeah. Well, it's good to know that, you know, I came out of my fellowship and did part-time anesthesia. And I was intentional about being part-time because I was trying to kind of create my life and I didn't want to live a certain standard of living that I would be stressed out to maintain financially. Yeah. So I always started out part-time. So they gave me the time and the resources to kind of play with other things. And so it's interesting, this book would probably not have happened if it wasn't for an interaction with an older gentleman who had like a 90-something-year-old father he was talking about at the gym. And I was just impressed with the guy I was talking about. And then he started talking about his father, and somehow it came into this pain world. And then I started giving I felt compelled. Sometimes, I had to reel myself back in, because sometimes, people don't want to hear this. This guy was like eating it up. And yeah, he's like, you have a message. You need to put it out there. And, and I just laughed when he said something about writing a book. And then, but that planted the seed. So, fast forward from, I finished my fellowship in 2009, and I had this building frustration with the system and feeling like people are being led astray and not being told the truth. And it's just such a complicated medical system that we have, this whole medical industrial complex that we have. And so I put myself in some conferences that are totally non-medical. There were like people that have written books, marketing kind of conferences, self-development, personal improvement kind of things. And I was so jazzed. I mean, I got so jazzed by the people in those settings, and they were so happy. And I was like, these are my people. Like, I love being around this energy. It gets me inspired. It makes me think about doing things that I never thought about doing. Because sometimes in the lull of everyday work, it's sometimes in medicine, a lot of people that are burned out, it can drain you. So I was lifted by a lot of this. And I had a breakout session in one of these, and they said, think about your book and what you'd like to call it. And I don't know where it came from. I mean, of course, the pandemic now did not happen.
Yeah, right now.
We're right in the middle of, but pandemic popped in my head. And I was super excited about that word. And they're like, please share with people in your small group. You have to trust that they're going to do the right thing and not steal it and all this. And so people were very, they thought it was cool. So this whole pandemic arose, I went ahead and just registered it as a trademark so that, you just never know. But, this whole book came about because I started giving value to my voice. There is always levels of doubt, as physicians, as humans, we do, what we're comfortable with. And so I think, speaking of even going from like pain back to anesthesia, that those shifts and those changes are really, really hard. And, so I felt like, it was just a strong enough message and a strong enough why for me to put it out there. And so I was just going through articles after articles, and I don't know if you saw in the back of the book, there's tons of references.
Yeah.
And those have all been read by me. And I would highlight and make notes, and I realized that doing blocks of time, like on airplanes where I was kind of couldn't really do much, like in my house or get distracted,
yeah, right.
I would have a journal or I have my little memo in my phone, and I would just start going nuts and just everything I got passionate about, I just started writing it. And so then I would just take all of that information and throw it on a Microsoft Word document. And then I started pruning it a little bit. But the book itself and trying to know how to publish that, I went to a conference about publishing your like own book or,
yeah, sure.
And I had the draft that I'd put together, and they had this really cool session where you had two people, and one of them was probably going to be someone associated with the publisher that was putting on this conference. And I just kind of pitched my book. I had like 2 minutes, and the guy was like, do you have a draft? And I was like, well, actually I do on my computer. So I emailed it. It got accepted. It was a hybrid publisher. So you have to market yourself, but they help with all the basic steps. So that's how my book, that was in 2013 when I pitched it, or 2014, I pitched it. Came up with the name in 2013. I pitched it in 2014, finalized like the arrangement of it all in 2015. It was released in I think February 2016. So the book, its intention was to share my perception at that time. I've evolved a lot even over these past 5 years, but my perception of what were what chronic pain is or what pain is and like what the medical system is and a more holistic look at it so that people go into this system with their eyes wide open. And that was my intention. It was to empower people to recognize that there's way more to pain than people realize. And there's way more complexity in this system and how people can be led astray. And I knew that, you know, you've seen people that have 10 surgeries on their pre-ops, you know, going into surgery, and it was meant to treat pain. It wasn't because of maybe a dropped foot or something. You see people right. that have pain, they've tried all these things, but yet they're still back.
Yeah.
So that's where all of that came from.
Well, and it's very interesting when it comes to, well, I guess with pain, it's so difficult to assess, right? I mean, I think that the first part of the book, I think in many ways is trying to find a definition and sort of an explanation for why pain exists and what it is, right? It's a perception thing. It's not necessarily mechanical. It's a very elusive, right? And that's what makes it so difficult for someone who's going to diagnose someone with pain, because it's really pretty nonspecific, and yet it's a real thing, right? And mm-hmm. everyone experiences it. I mean, we obviously know there's pain's a thing, but is your intent sort of just to tell people like pain's okay, it's normal, and that you have some control over it? Because I feel like a lot of times there are people who just feel like it just happened to them and then there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah. So if it's okay, I'll bridge kind of what I was putting out to how I perceive it now. I tried to use a lot of the literature that is not constructed around the most, like there was some introduction of the more modern science of pain. But, you know, I feel like I was still trying to put the terminology and the definitions of the traditional look at pain. So, which is why this year I'm promising myself, trying to hold myself accountable, that I'm going to write my updated version of Paindemic, and prune it even more and simplify it down even more, because it is quite dense, the book itself. And so there's aspects that I feel like are like stay the same. There's things that I'd want to change. And a lot of that is trying to define it. The best way to describe it, it's an experience. So mm-hmm. it's not some objective thing. And I just was part of an online conference I participated in this past weekend. And they talk about that all pain is pain. All pain is real, and that all pain can change. And I think it's a perfect summary of that, that it's an experience that you have to believe the person in front of you. Of course, could somebody lie and not be experiencing pain and just have some other objective? Sure. I would say most people aren't going to waste their time. You know,
yeah.
If they're in pain, they're in pain, and you just take their word for it. The problem is we have a very simplified, sequential type of, this is very linear. This happens and you have pain. But the overall, if you talk to my friend, Dr. Kevin Gaccaro, he has a really, I think it's like an hour presentation on, you know, why we hurt, and a simplified like metaphor. And I think that's a great way to look at it. But essentially, sensory input is what we're used to. We're thinking also the sensory input is the reason we have pain, like it lights up, and it's a very sequential, like linear thought to pain. But that's not really what's going on. There might be an extreme, big, huge sensory component, like all these receptors that receive information, like someone's leg gets cut off without any anesthesia, like the blocks you do. There's a huge sensory component, but there's so many other things that are influencing from the top. So emotions, your belief, your cognitions, your thoughts about what this means. So the meaning you put to that, you can look at different cultures that, you know, have different things happen to them that you would think they'd be screaming and writhing in pain, but it might be considered a very positive thing. And they don't, it's a different kind of stoicism. And it just, you can see so many differences in how people respond to just sensory input, because there's the thoughts and beliefs and emotions that tie into it. So I always remind people, if you stub your toe and you just want $1 million, you don't care about the stub toe,
right?
You know, but if you just got an argument with your significant other, then you know, that stub toe probably hurts twice as much. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
So the point is that those are just very simplified, a few things that contribute to the experience of pain. But there are so many things in our environment, our past, our traumas, our just what we believed at that point in time when that happened and how we interpret it for the current situation. I'm sure even with a pediatrician, they probably could tell you maybe there was some micro traumas from just injections and they respond differently. And then later in life, they don't know why they pass out the moment they see a needle. Like, you just don't know. Sure. There's so many things. So I think that with pain, I've recognized it's super fascinating because it is I compared it in my book, you know, it's not quite love. I mean, you think that's more the antidote to pain, but how do you describe love? You know, you can't really just grab it in the air. It's something, there's so many sensory inputs that create that experience. And the way we're going about it in medicine is as if it's just this, you know, thing that happens at this place you feel it. But ironically, all of our pain is constructed in our brain. It's not in your head as if you're crazy. It's just, it's all constructed there. And so whatever sensory information that's coming in, it can be modulated by the brain and spinal cord. So it just reminds us that we're one system that's picking up inputs in so many different ways. And even the way we understand the brain as if this spot is responsible for speech or whatever, there's actually multiple locations always communicating. And as you just look at people who've lost parts of the brain and then it adapts and accommodates. And I think it's just a fascinating realm of medicine, but the way we've been going about it has been, it's been not good for patients, and it's had serious consequences. And despite doing, you know, 500 to 1,000% more interventions and treating it like this thing down there that's causing the problem, we have more pain in this country than we've ever had before.
Yeah, that's a great way of, I love comparing it to love because it is, it's a human experience we all, well, should all except point, some point experience. And, and it has definitely physical components, but it also has maybe more mental or, you know, right? It's emotional. And I like the part of the book where you talk about how it, and I don't even know if I can pronounce this properly, but diagnocentric way of looking at things, where the example would be, well, we do it all the time in medicine, where we say, hey, are we going to do this? Are we doing the ankle fracture next? Yep, we're going to do the ankle fracture, right? Right. So we oftentimes describe patients as a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Like the gallbladder's coming in next. Like, I mean, obviously gallbladder's coming in, this person's coming in, they all have gallbladders, but sort of the notion that you are just whatever your diagnosis is. I'm a person with chronic fatigue syndrome, or I've got CRPS, which is chronic regional pain syndrome in my left foot. And that's kind of who I am. And I love how you, well, I guess I'll let you just talk about sort of what that means and how people sort of get away from that sort of problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So I first came up with the word diagnocentricity. I'm like, no one's going to want to hold on to that. But are you diagnocentric is a little easier. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're egocentric or, you know, people can kind of relate to that word, that if your world and your thought, everything revolves around a diagnosis, then it's hard to decouple and actually imagine that you can be a full person beyond that. And so I think that, you know, just like you said, even as physicians or clinicians, we get diagnosed-centric, we get focused on the diagnosis and not the whole person. I think it's not good for patients to fixate on something that could have been an inappropriate diagnosis, not accurate. And so you're barking up the wrong tree, you know, and these things that are, it's like they're things to just like fix. And much of pain is about like this journey of understanding. There are so many things that, whether it's stress, whether it's lack of activity, whether it's extremely poor diet, lack of sleep, you know, just one night, even as physicians, you go all night without sleeping, you might have these aches and pains. Like, there's so many things that can layer upon each other. I like somebody had mentioned, like, a canvas. Our life is like a canvas. We kind of have these marks or maybe these things that have happened to us, and they start coloring our canvas, and we start layering it. We can change the way it looks by doing different things, but it doesn't mean it has to stay the same. So I feel like a diagnose-centric type of lifestyle or approach to medicine or approach to pain is a very limiting way, and not always appropriate, because there are times where a specific diagnosis is important. But when you're dealing with pain that doesn't resolve in a short period of time and it becomes chronic long-term, pain is pain regardless. These inputs that I talked about earlier are always relevant. You know, there might be more sensory input than other pieces, but things are always at play. And so if you get fixated on a diagnosis, then, you know, I feel like sometimes our strategy, you're taken away from the big picture of what pain is. It presents in different ways, but there are multiple things you can do for yourself, or other people can coach you through or facilitate to help you change some things to get the nervous system to calm down. And pain is all about protection. That's the biggest message. And if you think about anxiety around surgery, stress, everything that our body is doing, and I mean brain, physical body, whatever you want to say, the whole system is looking out for you. So it's all about protection, but they manifest in different ways. So that's where my curiosity and intrigue is magnified, because when you think of pain, we all manifest stress in different ways, manifest pain in different ways. Of course, certain injuries can, you know, manifest things a certain way as well. But, you know, some people get stressed out, might feel like they need to go, you know, pee all the time or have a GI episode. Some people get headaches. Some people get back pain. Some people get, you know, neck pain. But it's hard to extricate all these things and make it real simple. And it's very distressful for physicians when you feel like you have to do something to somebody. And the way we made people perceive us is that we have the answer, and that to be a good doctor, we're going to fix them. But the problem is that when pain is one of those things that doesn't self-resolve within a healing time, if there was an injury, which, by the way, pain, it's not always involved with injuries. Your kid can be nervous and have abdominal pain, but you're not going to cut on them.
Right.
You know, so I can get pretty passionate about that. But if we get fixated on diagnosis, it's, you know, a patient is not a diagnosis. They're a whole person. And if the patient fixates on the diagnosis, they are not addressing all the many things that could potentially help them with their pain.
Talk about then, this kind of goes into the next part, right? Like the anti-pain lifestyle. So you talk about, if you're someone who has pain, how do you either cope with it, deal with it, alter the sort of your state in it? Because no one wants to be in pain. I mean, I think we all accept pain at times, and we recognize it has a, you know, utility. Like, you touch a hot stove, you want to move your hand away. You exercise a lot, you have that sort of the ache the next day. That's a sign that something good happened. But obviously you don't want to have that feeling all the time. So why did you just go through the anti-pain lifestyle? What you mean by it?
Sure. Well, and let me just make a statement. There are people that have misconstrued me to say that I'm anti-medicine or like anti-medical field. There's a time and a place for everything. The problem is we default to the medical system all the time. And of course, they're there to rule out red flags. You know, if you're really worried about something, then you can have someone rule out those big things that could kill you, you know?
Right.
Once that's done, now granted, things could change and revert back to a medical emergency or red flag, and, you know, you have it readdressed. But there's a lot of fear and anxiety that wraps around people that have pain. We don't like it. It's by definition something
right.
Uncomfortable. And so emotionally, physically, however you want to put it, pain is pain. And so I like to look at the anti-pain lifestyle as just a way to minimize the interventions by the medical system. So the things you can do to help yourself, which I am biased. I'll say that from the get-go, because I found myself doing that, knowing that I have avoided, probably if I had pushed the medical system to take care of me and to do something for me, I could have very easily gotten it. No problem.
The incentives align, right?
It's what?
I was going to say the incentives align.
Sure, sure.
Right? So that, yeah.
If I demand it, there's something there. So, yeah. But the anti-pain lifestyle is, you know, I listed out several, you know, like a list of things that could, you know, that have been shown, like whether, you know, things I mentioned earlier, that just the things that are good for wellness are good for helping pain. Right. So that's an important part. But I would say that pain is your teacher. So, you know, the first thing, like if I have an episode, an acute episode of like some back pain or something, the first thing I do is I slow down and I take a deep breath. And, you know, people realize that the one thing you can literally control your breath, the one thing that's doing without you telling it to, it's the one thing you can interrupt and consciously do and activate the vagus nerve, which is tied into every other system in the body. So anything you can do to help calm the nervous system, which is, you know, the whole system your body's trying to protect you. So anything you can do to kind of slow yourself down in those moments. I mean, look at Lamaze and people having, you know, in childbirth. I mean, there's some evidence there that there's some good things. But slowing yourself down, that's the first thing you control, is to slow down the nervous system. And for me, I don't worry too much about what it means. And people are trying to make meaning out of their pain or trying to understand what's causing it. And I think there's times where that's important, especially if there's emergencies or red flags. For me, I actually internally, my thoughts revolve around the idea that I'm safe, it's okay, I slow down and take a deep breath, and I slow down my movement, or I change my movement. So for me, it's a very movement-based psychological process that I go through. And even if I'm in the middle of a, you know, I never start in a run right away, I'll move into it. I adapt myself slowly. So I don't go from a beginner to a marathon runner. That will likely lead to pain, not always, but I know from habit or in the past that if I go kind of ramp up my activity over time, my body has the ability to adapt, and it no longer feels like it needs to warn me that something might be going on or my muscles are trying to repair itself from like this journey of really difficult activity that I wasn't prepared for. I mean, look at athletes, there's a lot of adaptability and pacing that they do in their training, and there's a reason for that, so all the receptors don't fire off and get mad. I call it get mad, but and people have a problem with using those emotions, but for me, I just try to you know, be smart. Like if I am in a run and I start feeling knee pain, I don't think, oh gosh, I'm 46 years old and I can't run anymore. So that mentality changes my behavior to stop. What I do is I slow down. I kind of just walk off a little bit. I might change the way I put pressure through my foot, and then I don't have pain, or I'll stretch out my quadricep, which stretches out. Like, so I, whatever I'm attributing it to, it probably doesn't matter because I might be wrong. So our attributions as to why we have pain may not always come through. But if I know it's not an emergency, I work through my mindset and I work through adapting to the situation. Not what I can't do, but more of like, what can I do and how can I do it better? So, you know, so as far as the anti-pain lifestyle, that's part of it, is realizing this is trying to teach me something. Maybe it didn't like the way I was hitting the ground. I don't know, but I just change it, adapt it. And if it gets better, great. If not, then I haven't figured it out. And, you know, I just take a break and try it again. But I think, unfortunately, people have a lot of, either they know someone that had back pain and they were an invalid for the rest of their life, and yeah, there's associations with that and fears. And so you have to tap into what is, you have to have an awareness and a mindfulness about what you're feeling. And there's a lot of things that I listed about wellness. I mean, I can go through the whole list, but you know, as far as nutrition and you know, hydration was listed in there, but I'm listing all the things that are basic wellness. You know, if yeah, you think of all the extremes, you can't go without, like, you can't go without food for too long, and you can't go without water for too, like, just basic wellness things, just to kind of cover your bases. But people, if they kind of really be honest with themselves, because our normal lives may actually not be healthy. You know, we've normalized what's, you know, what we're used to. So there's things that you have to be honest with yourself and look at all these various wellness aspects I list in the book and the things that maybe you're not being attending to your health. Maybe you're not attending to the unhealthy relationships in your life that are creating a stressor for you. And if you don't believe that stress or, you know, unhealthy life, if you don't believe stress affects you physically, you just find a kid that's stressed out about going to see a bully at school. You can tell there's physical symptoms. At least they're expressing that. You have to believe that. We believe everything else in medicine when people describe things. But somehow when you can't see something, that linear thought process again, you don't want to believe that they're having pain. But you always have to believe that someone has pain. That is probably the worst thing that we do in this system, is to minimize, devalue their experience. And I think most of what I did to tie it back into my training, I gave people time. I validated their experience. I showed interest and curiosity in what they're going through. And they trusted me. And they believed that they could get better. I had that confidence, even though I had some doubts as to how much I could help them. My problem back then is that I tied their outcomes to my value. And I realize now that it's the journey. That journey, it doesn't necessarily happen overnight. And that's why it's so hard for someone like us with acute pain service stuff to not get burned out, because we tie those outcomes to us and how good we are. And I've realized that all I can do is be a facilitator of change, empower them, try to educate them. Problem is, in this world, the framework of which we're demonstrating what pain is, patients don't really get the more modern understanding of pain, because as clinicians, we're not demonstrating that to them. We're making it seem like we can fix them. So it's this dual letdown. And so we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot there. So I feel like patients, the best people, I've done a couple of coaching things online. And I literally had one person after one session just say all she needed was someone to let her know she wasn't going to hurt herself by moving and that she wasn't going to damage her spine. So the messaging that we give people, even by degenerative disc disease, that diagnocentric thing you talked about, you know, who cares? They're like wrinkles, you know, they're like wrinkles on our face. We never say you have pain because you have wrinkles in your face. I say that in the book too, but you know, the internal aspects of us are going to look different. It doesn't mean it's associated with pain. We have plenty of people that have all that and have no pain. So a lot of ironies.
Yeah. The thing that runs through the book is movement. And so it's important with pain that you continue moving. You don't stop but you just move differently. Like you said, you listen to your body and do something a little, stop and go slower, or don't bend over that one way or whatever it might be, or look for someone to find who can help you find, you know, those exercises or whatever it might be to stretch a joint out or do a simple manipulation. And I think the tricky thing with back pain, I spent in medical school, we had to do rotation in orthopedics. I ended up on the back team for 2 weeks. And the things I always will remember are the head surgeon said, and he had a horrible displaced intervertebral disc. I think it's like L3-4 or something like that. And he was in agony for 6 to 9 months, never had anyone operate on it because he'd seen people who had operated on, and now they're usually not a whole lot better off 5 years out. Plus they've got a surgical scar and there are changes that happen with that. And now the next time you have to have surgery, if you had to have it, it's a, you know, bigger endeavor. You've got to have instrumentation, fusions or whatever. And so that I took that away from that. And that was sort of the big thing but also we would see people who had neurologic deficits because of something happening in their spine, and they absolutely had to have surgery, right? Because if you don't, then you have permanent weakness and resulting. And that's the whole thing. You have to not always assume things are nothing, but listen to your body. And if there's something that's concerning, you have someone check and make sure it's nothing that is irreversible or potentially, right? And then once you get past that part, which is probably fairly rare most of the time, then you just have to find an intervention, right, to sort of take care of things. You also talk about genetics, and I think this has become something that has changed a lot in our thinking. I mean, I had Jason Fung on recently. We talked about cancer and how our thought of just cancer and genes and mutations and has changed radically since I left medical school. I mean, the stuff we were talking about, I'd never heard of. And epigenetics is a thing that really outside of, I want to say her name is McClintock. Is she the one who did the epigenetics with corn where the different genes would jump from one kernel to the next and change the different... I think she won the Nobel Prize from that because she's the one who first discovered that that genes could change based on their environment. And so that, you know, but the genetics are not, they're not static. And I think we've always thought, oh, I'm going to be 5'8" and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm going to be 5'8". Well, we know that's not true because it depends on what your nutrition status is, right? You might not be 5'8". You might be 5'4".
Right, right.
Or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Talk briefly about genes and how, you know, maybe instead of just letting the genes sort of tell us who we are, you kind of mentioned we need to tell our genes who we are.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm always in a debate with my mother about this. she comes from, you know, her generation and how genetics is much more of a driver for who you are and what you become, what you look like and all these things. And, you know, genetics are just this encoding, but you have to create the proteins. So, you know, the epigenetics is how, you know, how you're transcribing from that genetic code and various types of behaviors can dictate what is created from that genetic code. And so that's how I kind of see epigenetics. That wasn't the exact definition. Your listeners should look that up. But in general, everything that I talked about from a wellness standpoint will more positively influence your genetic code to create the proteins and the various things that can drive, you know, whether you're, you know, your body composition or, you know, various types of, you know, medical issues that could happen. And so that's kind of part why I inserted, and I think I only had like a couple sentences of that in there, but it was part of that whole anti-pain lifestyle that what you're doing is influencing your genes. So from an epigenetic standpoint, that phenomenon is, it's crucial and it's important, you know, how much each particular behavior is influencing. I mean, it'd be hard for anyone to put that on with a number,
right.
But what you do in your life and, you know, trust me, being human in this world and all the conveniences, it's hard to be perfect. I have my own challenges at times as well. But I think it's really enlightening to make you feel like you don't have to be as diagnose-centric about a diagnosis that you could potentially influence if it's an accurate diagnosis in the first place. You could influence those things. I mean, even people with like Parkinson's disease, based on your lifestyle, can influence how quickly that, you know, I'm not a Parkinson's expert, but you see people that they get the diagnosis, but they've kind of put it on a mild version of it versus like a terrible, severe form of it, based on how they radically change their lives. And I think that's incredibly inspirational and reminds us that we have some power over our genetics and that we're not just a victim to these genes. Now, there's some things that are, you know, if you're missing a particular type of chemical in the body, it has to be replaced.
Sure.
I mean, there's certain things that are extremes, but many of us who are healthy during our first few decades, you know, and then suddenly start having these chronic things or autoimmune things. Like, it's amazing how you change your nutrition and diet or change your lifestyle or decrease your stress in your life. And that can change the, you know, trajectory of what your health is doing. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I think so. And I mean, I guess my simplified thought of epigenetics is really like the genome that you have is pretty much like a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only make, you know, if you don't have all the ingredients, you can't make certain things. And so I think, and it can only do what it has access to. And that whether, and also there's some obvious things too, right? Like if I lift a lot of weights and do a lot of physical activity, I'm going to be stronger or whatever than if I don't do those things. I mean, that has genetics have, they have some effect obviously on how well you'll be able to do and what your maximum achievement can be. But
yes.
absolutely you're dependent on what you can do in life. And for most people, unless you're going to try and be on the tippy top elite of whatever it might be, it doesn't matter. I mean, you're still going to be doing pretty well if as long as you adhere to some basic things. And so I think, you know, that's the message of your book, that you have some control over these things. It's hard to define. And I, before we sort of throw all physicians under the bus for doing too many procedures and doing things that are inappropriate, I think, you know, when people come to you with a problem and you have a solution that works sometimes, you're inclined to use it. And you can't fix things that you don't know about. So if people don't tell you that, oh, I've, you know, someone passed away and I also lost my job and there are a couple other things going on that may contribute to the pain, I mean, you're not going to be able to fix those things. But maybe you can fix the person who's got, you know, maybe the nerve block helps or something, right? I mean, I think that there's definitely, there's an allure to that for a physician to try and fix those things. And sometimes they help, right? So that's a hard thing.
And that's interesting. Why they help is a bigger question. And true. I don't, certain people have been in my circles recognize that I'm different than the other pain physicians that are doing interventions in the surgery center that I, but interestingly that particular physician, the pain physician, read my book and he's now converted to a non-opioid practice. I'm not saying I was part of that. I think because he was kind of leaning in that direction of thinking, I'm not really helping people live their lives. I don't think this is the best solution. I think he was open to reading my book. That was part of it.
Yeah.
But you only know what you've been taught. And then over time, as you observe things, if you're honest and you're willing to overcome what's called cognitive dissonance and this discomfort of recognizing that maybe what I was taught is not really the way for everyone, and the financial benefits that I've been receiving from that type of way, if you're willing to overcome that, you'll recognize, and unfortunately for some close friends of mine, it was an extremely, I have like probably five physicians that have stopped doing interventions that I know. In different realms, but they're all pain physicians. And it's extremely distressing, anxiety provoking, nearly life destroying, because your identity is wrapped around with what you're doing. And so it is a very difficult for those that are maybe willing to, you know, realize that the journey of going through understanding pain can be painful in and of itself, is real. And I do believe it's worth it, because you actually can look at your own life and recognize the stress, the anxiety, and the pain. The biggest messages, like I said, are pain is about protection. And if you realize that all this anti-pain lifestyle that I framed it that way, it's all about finding things that make your body feel safe. And you're trying, for some reason, your body is perceiving danger, whether it's sensory components that, yes, maybe if that injection was done, the sensory input is different for that period of time, or they believe that that's the thing that needs to be done, or they love seeing those people on a frequent basis and love seeing that physician and the caring attitude and the comfort they receive. All of those same things can help people feel safe. Those are just a few examples. It is important, if you finally go down that road, which I implore every pain physician to do, is to learn about a little bit of the science of pain. And when you do, it's incumbent upon you to share at least the resources for your patients, to recognize there are other things I can do, because it's not always just one thing in our life that can make our life better or our pain better. Right. There are so many things that are layered upon each other that can have this kind of like this ripple effect. And so I think that there's a lot of ways, you know, people that have trauma, you know, even expressive writing has been, I don't understand how it works, but apparently it does amazing things. And so if you can embrace and help those people willing to help themselves, and you give them more than just what you can do to them, you'd be surprised. There are people out there that they just need the resources. They just need to know. And if they want to work through that journey, it is their job to work through that. They may need a coach along the way, but I think learning about pain in a way that is practical, more modern, will help you not only with your own life, but your own patients.
Yeah, well, that's a great message. Well, we've come to the end of the conversation here. Where's a great place for people to keep track of you and your writings, and so they'll know when the next book comes out?
Yeah. If you just go to challengedoctor.com or thechallengedoctor.com, they're the same place, or myname.com, but challengedoctor is the easiest way. And for those, you can read about why I name myself that, but I think I challenge myself and society and the medical system, and even the word itself has the word change within it. So you can see change within challenge, first three letters, last three letters. Spell change.
Oh, that's very clever. Clever, yeah. Well,
so I use that phrase, the challenge doctor, for a lot of reasons. Just gives us some different perspective. I like reframing things.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Melissa Cady, co-host of the Change Physician podcast, which I'd highly recommend you add to your list if you're not currently listening. Today was anything but a pain talking to you, so thanks so much.
Most welcome. It's always a painless experience and joyful experience to spend time with you.
To talk later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. But before we end, don't forget to reach out to MedEvolve. For those of us who know how hard it is to build and maintain a sustainable business, we understand that bringing the right help to achieve our goals is really important. Get in touch with them for data-driven analytics, workflow automation, and medical billing technology and services by going to www.drpodcastnetwork.com/MedEvolve and get going on the right path.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.